Oh, yeah. So, Saturday, coming to the end of the line for this cycle on the settling the mind in its natural state. There's just one more method I'd like to introduce you to. Some of you, I think, are not yet familiar with it. It's not commonly taught in this practice of shamatha, focus on the mind, or settling the mind in its natural state, but it is taught by one of the great adepts from the late 19th, early 20th century named Lerap Lingba. I mentioned him earlier, and I received this transmission from one of his two incarnations, Kempo Jime Pinso, about 20 years ago. When teaching settling the mind in its natural state, then what Lerap Lingba, the earlier incarnation, suggests is, number one, sitting in the upright position, so in that context. So this is no good for the supine position. But in the upright position, sitting upright, then engaging what's called the gentle Voss breathing. Okay, some of you are familiar with it, some not. For those who are not familiar with it, here it is. So there's another type, just as an aside, there's something called the Voss breathing, which is part of Tummo practice. It's a very advanced pranayama technique, which can be very, very powerful and also very, very damaging. And so that I'm not teaching, because that has to be done under very skillful guidance and with prolonged monitoring to make sure that nothing's going awry. This gentle Voss breathing is really not dangerous at all. It's very, very gentle, and here's what it entails. And that is, once again, one is allowing the breathing to flow unimpededly, effortlessly, so you're not trying to breathe in long or short, you're not holding the breath. No funny business, just letting it flow in and out. But there is some modification. And so when breathing in, number one, you keep your belly really loose and relaxed. So if you haven't learned how to do that, learn how. Keep it really relaxed. And as you breathe in, then naturally the abdomen expands. And as you normally breathe out, then the abdomen, and I'm placing my hand on my belly right now just to make it a bit more obvious. As you're breathing out, then the abdomen comes back in again. Everybody knows that. Okay. So the gentle Voss breathing is a subtle maneuver here, where as you breathe in, the abdomen expands as usual. But as you breathe out, you simply hold a pot-like shape, hence Voss breathing or pot breathing. As you breathe out, you just hold a roundness or a pot-like shape, a mild protuberance there in the abdomen. And when doing this, if your experience is like mine, you may have a sense when you're breathing out, just gently holding that roundness and allowing the breath to entirely flow out. It's just holding the roundness. You may have a sense of really settling. So breathing in, and then breathing out, holding that fullness. And that's it. It's just holding that fullness throughout, which gets a little bit fuller as you breathe in, falls back a little bit as you're breathing out, but again maintains a fullness, so it doesn't retract like normal. So what's the reason for doing that? Is that it has been found by yogis for a very long time that if this is done skillfully, that it loosens the abdomen up, and such that the, now speaking in first-person physiology, there's a major chakra down there, four finger widths beneath the navel chakra. And it's a very complex one, and there are many nadis coming out from it, and they tend to be very blocked. So the prana cannot flow normally. And most specifically, the prana from the two subsidiary channels cannot flow into the central channel, which would be a really good idea. But they remain blocked, and these two subsidiary channels or nadis are related to craving and aversion. And so that's where we're operating most of the time. I like this, I don't like that, hope, fear, and all of that. And the idea is to come into the center, where there's just a clear presence free of craving and aversion. So by holding that fullness, it kind of just creates a more spacious quality there in the abdomen. And with a deep sense of relaxation that's running through the entire practice, then the nadis begin to untangle, the knots begin to loosen up a bit, and then experientially, you may sense the prana, the energy there in the gut, starting to come into the center and then come up the middle. Right, coming right up the middle of your torso through that central channel. That's a very healthy thing to happen. It's also an adjunct that because of the movements of the prana into the central channel, this actually accentuates or supports your samadhi, right? Rather than getting caught up in excitation involving desire and aversion. So it's a very subtle, very gentle pranayama technique. And so we see, once again, there's a synergy taking place here. And that is, the deeper you settle your mind in its natural state, the more the prana begins to flow. A number of you found this already. A lot of energy movement, sometimes kind of spurts, spikes of energy, surges of energy, and so forth. So the more deeply you relax into the practice, the energy starts to flow more smoothly, the knot starts to unravel. So it's having a kind of a top-down, so to speak, a top-down influence from mind to subtle energy to body. But similarly, by bringing about this subtle modification, this holding of the gentle vas breathing, then from the body up, you're making a greater looseness, a spaciousness in the gut, which facilitates the loosening of the knots around that navel chakra, which enables the prana to start coming in, and that in turn helps samadhi, brings about a real stillness, a real clarity and focus of attention. So a synergy from prana to mind, from mind to prana. Okay? So having said that, one can ask, is this practice indispensable? Is this integral to the practice of settling the mind in its natural state? The answer is no. I've seen it only in one place, and that was in these teachings of Lerap Lingba. Many people find them helpful, and many other people don't. Just like counting the breath. Some people really like doing it, some people really don't. It's just a nuisance, it clutters the mind. Some people find this gets just more involved in multitasking, it clutters the practice, and you'd really like to disengage your mind entirely from the somatic field and focus entirely on the mental field. So what I would suggest is, at least for one session, or you might even try for a few more, after this one session that we'll attend to this collectively, experiment with it. I hope it's all clear. And then if you find it helpful, then why not continue? You can continue this while standing, like waiting in line for the food in the cafeteria. You can do it while walking. One posture it does not work well for is lying down. I would not suggest it there. It's too contrived, too forced, and so wouldn't suggest it there. And now from this day, this being the final day in this cycle that we're practicing settling the mind in its natural state, next week we go to Shamatha without a sign. The week after that, merging mind with space. So for those two practices, you can certainly continue. If you like this, the gentle vas breathing, you can definitely continue that with those practices as well. I don't really recommend it for mindfulness of breathing. I would say kind of don't mess with that. It's a complete practice all by itself. There's no references to gentle vas breathing. So it might be okay, but as you know, I'm really a traditionalist. I like to do practices that have been around for 1,000 years, give me more confidence. And so this is not a combination that I've ever seen taught by any great meditation master, mindfulness of breathing together with gentle vas breathing. So I don't see why I should start it now. These practices have such splendor, such power, integrity in and of themselves, whereas the gentle vas breathing is completely compatible with these practices we find in Tibetan Buddhism, settling the mind in its natural state, shamatha without a sign, merging mind with space, okay. Any of those three. But again, take it or leave it. If it's helpful, cool. If it's not, whatever. No problemo. Okay? Please find a comfortable position. And now I've front-loaded it. We'll need hardly any instruction during the session at all. You can single-pointedly focus on the practice and not have to multitask, going back from the instructions back to your practice. settle your body's speech and mind in the natural states, and for a little while, calm the mind with mindfulness of breathing. Then either making a gradual segue from focusing on the space of the body and whatever tactile sensations arise within it over to the space of the mind. You may do so gradually, or if you feel comfortable with the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, go there directly, focusing your mind on the space of the mind and its contents, monitoring mindfulness with introspection, and applying the antidotes to excitation and laxity as needed. Let's continue practicing now in silence. Lasso. So let's look at a few questions that have accumulated here. This one left over from before, I think it's probably pretty well covered, but I'll, since it has multiple parts, I will read it. This is from Suzanne. If all the Buddhas and deities are not out there, but instead are expressions of our own ground awareness, how does prayer fit into the picture? Coarse mind speaking to subtle mind. Coarse mind speaking to your own pristine awareness, manifesting objectively as Tara, Buddha Shakyamuni, whoever it may be. There's a cute, silly little joke of a person who became an atheist. And he said, well, I became an atheist when it suddenly dawned on me that when I was praying, I was the only one listening. And it's true, right? But then, what's the reference to the word I? If you think I just the one located with the psyche, that's a pretty limited view. That's a materialistic view. If it's just the psyche and the substrate consciousness, not much dialogue there. If you bring in the third dimension, which really is transcendent, it is divine, pristine awareness, primordial consciousness, then it's a dialogue with your innermost being, manifesting symbolically as these archetypal deities like Tara, manifesting as your guru, manifesting as the great adepts of the past, Padmasambhava, Tsongkhapa, and so forth. That's how that works. In times of difficulty or uncertainty in the past, I've often said heartfelt prayers to Tara, and generally they've been answered. I agree with you. I found the same thing. You're not alone. I am a believer, based upon experience. And is this because I tap into a higher dimension of consciousness which will always produce a more intelligent response? Yes. Is it because I make a connection with the enlightened ones who will always be there to help? Yes. A prayer usually originates from good intention, motivation, and virtuous deeds, thoughts will always ripen into virtuous results. Yes. Boy, that was easy. And I meant every single word. I was not being flippant. Definitely yes. Olaso, now from Aga. Through history until now, there have been so many people, including monks, nuns, and lay people, who spent countless hours in meditation but did not achieve shamatha, let alone liberation. That's true. It seems in comparison that only a special few managed to do so. Yeah, well, if you don't have many people even practicing it, then of course you don't have many people achieving it. If you don't have many people practicing it in a conducive environment with good spiritual companions and skillful guidance, they're going to have a real hard time too. So I'll just put that into the equation. Now, if we went back to the time of the Buddha, tons of people were achieving shamatha and stages of higher realization. And for the next 500, next 1,000 years, during the kind of the glory days, even 1,500 years, the glory days of Indian Buddhism before it died for various reasons, but some of them were very military. But during that first millennium of the Common Era, there were many achieved shamatha, many achieved siddhis, many, many. I meant to refer to a very interesting man I met about 20 years ago, no, 15, when I was teaching at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Very interesting fellow. We just immediately connected. He was a Sufi, and he was born in Jordan. He grew up in Jordan. This will look like a wild tangent, but I'm a wild tangenter. Grew up in Jordan, and then eventually became a Sufi, an accomplished Sufi, and also an atomic physicist. And he had a position, I think two positions at the University of Baghdad, in physics and in religion. And so he was teaching Sufi, and he was teaching atomic physics. Very interesting guy. And so he sought me out because of a book I wrote a long time ago called Choosing Reality, which is on physics and consciousness. And we really had a wonderful conversation, and he showed me a video of him as a dervish. He was a dervish, and the kind of siddhi they displayed, that he could display it and did, was sticking something that looked exactly like a knitting needle, a big, thick needle, long, sharp, and sticking it right through one cheek, having it go through the mouth and come out the other cheek, like a skewered pig, like that. And he did this, and with the permission of his teacher, he did this under laboratory conditions. I think it was the University of Cincinnati Medical School. He contacted them. They said, sure, we'll check it out. We're going to put you into the MRI. We're going to conduct this under controlled laboratory conditions to see whether there's any funny business, whether it's a trick, or whether you really are sticking a needle right through your jaw, through your mouth, both sides. So he said, he checked with his teacher, said, yeah, do it. Go ahead, show him. And he did. Total laboratory conditions. And there was, and they saw, that's very strange. Because when he put it in, he wasn't going, you know, no pain at all. Just right through one cheek, out through the other cheek. No apparent pain whatsoever. Goes into the MRI to show there's no, just no funny business. I mean, it's transparent. He comes out, he pulls the needle out. This was all on the video I saw. He pulls this big needle out, and the wounds cover right over. One little drop of blood, and that's it. And no pain anywhere in sight. It's a little city. It's a little city. And I asked him, well, why do you do that? You know, if you were flying, I could understand that, because you cut down on gasoline, and, you know, it could be actually very economical. It'd be a good way for people to get around. You know, no smog, no emissions. But sticking the needle, you know. And he said, well, that question has been asked before, and the answer is, just because. Actually, literally, just because. You know, why not? So why do I mention that? What he was doing research on people in Ethiopia, Egypt, I think it went to Pakistan or Afghanistan, bear in mind, this is a long time ago, and he was conducting research on siddhas, accomplished beings, Christian and Muslim primarily. Christian and Muslim. He was, of course, Muslim. And finding some really remarkable things found in northern North Africa and then in the Near East. And he said when he was growing up in Jordan as a child, really rural village, old school, old tradition, he said cities were really common. Everybody knew about them. In every village, there'd be somebody around. So, you know, we tend to think of it as that's really spooky and bizarre and it's probably all phony and Randy the weirdo or whatever his name is, you know, give $1 million to anybody who can, you know, do it. Well, that's a bunch of phony baloney. He's going to keep his $1 million no matter what. We can be sure of that. But so how rare? Well, we don't really know. How rare was this in Tibet before the Chinese decimation of Tibetan Buddhism and the genocide there? So I think we can overstate it a bit. But when you come into a country, imagine Martians coming to the United States, or no, just planet Earth, and coming in and hating everything about science and demolishing every scientific lab and blowing up every university that teaches science on the planet, and then killing most of the scientists. Just rounding them up, putting concentration camp, and then just machine gunning the rest of them. And the rest of them, they just make them go off and become farmers. And then give it 50 years. How do you think science would be after 50 years of that? That's what happened in Tibet. That's what happened in Tibet. So then we wonder, oh, it's so rare, it's so rare. Yeah, kill everybody, and it's really rare. And it wasn't just Tibet, it was Mongolia. They killed 30,000 monks there under Stalin. And other communist regimes. It was that this was the biggest holy war in the history of humanity, by atheists waging war against religion. So the whole notion of beating up in religions because of awful holy wars, the atheists have killed more people in the 20th century than all the holy wars in history. So I really don't buy that. Sam Harris writes about this. He's really got to do a little bit more reading of history because he's so naive. I'm sorry to pick on a person, but he really beats this one. It's really quite absurd. It's juvenile. Sorry, Sam, but that writing there is really awful. I think you're probably a very nice person. So there it is. It's rare because it's rare to find the conducive circumstances, rare to find the teacher, rare to find the people teaching it and so forth. That's why it's rare. So the question is it possible that Buddha was just rarely gifted? No, it wasn't just him at all. This was achieved in China. It was really quite common there. In India, Southeast Asia long ago, not so common now. But again, very few people are teaching it authentically. And so, something gifted like something like Einstein in physics or Mozart in music, and if so, what about the rest of us, especially those less gifted, far less gifted, you know, less gifted than a Buddha? Sure. Well, the fact that His Holiness Dalai Lama is now speaking, as I said before, really all over the world, saying, you should really practice shamatha, you should really achieve shamatha. And he's saying this to lay people, monastics, East and West, to his own Tibetan monks, I think something like 5,000 of them in the south of India, just recently saying, hey, we should really be focusing on shamatha and achieving it. Because it somehow just slipped through the cracks. But the fact that he is saying that, probably he's the most savvy Tibetan Buddhist alive, I would imagine, he wouldn't be saying that if he thought it was a write-off. Like, hey, why don't you just get really frustrated and try something you can't possibly accomplish? You know, he's much kinder than that. But then it's not enough to encourage people. You have to create the environment for that to do. And that's why he's encouraging, really supporting strongly, and wanting, and has pledged money to create a conducive environment near Bangalore, which is one of the nicest places in all of India. Really gentle climate. Bangalore is called the Garden City. It's near about 10,000 monks, Tibetan monks, who are living in Mysore and Bailakupi and so forth. So he takes this very seriously. If he does, then I think anybody who has confidence in him should similarly take it seriously. And that means create conducive environments. I call them contemplative observatories. Get people in clusters so they have some group energy like we have right here, but not for 8 weeks, but for a year, 5 years, 10 years. And then invite scientists to the party. Let this not be one more thing of religion versus science, spirituality versus science. Invite the scientists to the party and let them monitor, let them help. Maybe they can make some good suggestions about diet, behavior, health issues that come up. Let them be part of the party. Invite them in, you know? Let the scientists become some of the contemplatives. And some of the contemplatives really learn science. Then you have the hybrids that His Holiness has been speaking about for years, people professionally trained in both Western science as well as contemplative practice. So, second, most of us after this retreat will go back to our engaged lives where we'll have limited time to devote to meditation. In this case, is it still possible to achieve shamatha, maybe in a different way, for example, through the cultivation of relative bodhicitta? Well, relative bodhicitta generally is not presented as a method for achieving shamatha. It's a method for achieving something immeasurably more meaningful than shamatha, relative bodhicitta. And so the general strategy would be first achieve a sublime state of sanity, shamatha, and then use that sanity, that supple, malleable, stable, clear, relaxed, clear mind, and use that to achieve shamatha. Now, can you achieve shamatha by way of cultivating loving kindness? Yes, that's a possibility. We have many, many other techniques as well. But is it possible to do so while living a socially engaged way of life? There I'll give the example of climbing through scree, like climbing up a steep mountain through scree, S-C-R-E-E. This is loose gravel, small rocks and so forth. We've all seen it. And if you've ever tried to climb up a really steep hill with loose gravel, you're climbing up and falling back, climbing up. And hopefully you can climb up faster than you're falling back. Otherwise, you're just, you know, creating a lot of dust. And so so the real question is a simple matter of addition and subtraction. It's arithmetic in terms of can you achieve shamatha while living a socially engaged way of life? And that is every time you sit on your cushion, if you're practicing knowledgeably, effectively, skillfully, you're really cultivating these qualities, relaxation, stability, and vividness, then every time you're on the cushion, you're adding. You're adding, you're moving towards shamatha, so that's addition. You're cultivating, developing, adding to your abilities, right? But then every time you step off the cushion and you're cooking breakfast and talking and watching television and answering email and going to work and riding and getting caught in heavy traffic and so forth, it's subtraction. Because that's when your mind is getting dispersed, probably getting caught up in rumination and so forth. So then do the math. And that is from day to day to day, are you adding more than you're subtracting? It's just that simple. And if you're not, then you can say, well, what's the point? You know, if I'm just going around in circles, if I'm just kind of treading water like, you know, spinning my wheels. And what's the point? Well, if you spend 1/2 hour a day in shamatha, practice, for example, and that's not a rounded diet, but it is certainly a good practice. Rounded diet would be doing other practices for cultivating the heart, like loving kindness, devotional practice, and so forth. Another type is cultivating insight, wisdom, understanding, knowledge. So the prajna, the wisdom, that's a rounded diet for the heart, for the mind, and for your attention skills, which is like, you know, like enzymes, so you can really digest whatever your practices are for the heart and for the mind. But if you do spend some time, half an hour, whatever, even though you may not be progressing along the path of shamatha, what you should expect should happen is that this is going to increase the overall sanity, the clarity, the open-heartedness, the empathy, the stability of your mind, so that throughout the whole course of the day, the overall quality of your life and quality of mind is improved. So even though you're not progressing in shamatha per se, the whole quality of your life should be improving. And if it's not, then I say find some other kind of practice, because it's not working, right? Especially if you have shamatha and the lojong, that's an incredible combination. If that doesn't help, I'll quote my teacher, Gishin Ondaige, when he was teaching us the Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. And he said, if you practice this and it doesn't help your mind, you should take your mind out and hit it with a rock. So if you don't get any benefit out of these 8 weeks with these incredibly wonderful shamatha practices and 7-point mind training and the Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, then I am really either a terrible teacher or something else. But there is a gradient here. That is it all or nothing? If you really are serious about wanting to follow the path of shamatha, do you have to drop off everything, not go to university, quit your jobs, say hasta la vista to family and head off to a cave? Is it either that or no progress? And I don't believe that it's binary like that. Either become an absolute renunciate, live in a cave, what have you, or else, you know, just generally have a good life and improve the quality of your mind and live a virtuous life and hope for a good rebirth. There's, especially with the many lifestyles that we have today, there's a lot in between there. So I'll give one example that I know. One elderly woman, I knew her quite well. I still know her quite well, but she was actually my benefactor. She provided me with a little cabin to meditate for a six-month retreat many years ago. She was retired, elderly, financially secure, very little social life, although she was a very friendly person, but she lived out in the desert. She asked me to teach her meditation, so I did. So, and she was practicing 4 or 5 hours a day. And she would watch a bit of television, be on the phone with her friends, go shopping, meet with friends once in a while, had no family, but she was meditating 4 or 5 hours a day. She did very well in her shamatha practice. She really progressed. So she wasn't a yogini, like, you know, hardcore. She wasn't just kind of pissing away her time watching soap operas. There was something very meaningful there. So there's a lot in between, and I think that's one of the great adventures of people living in the modern world. What are the variations there? And so how could one elevate the whole quality of mindful presence, of loving kindness, of empathy, of practicing a spiritual alchemy to transform everything in life into the spiritual path so that you're subtracting very little in between sessions, but in fact transforming, enhancing, and enriching and deepening your practice between sessions in loving kindness, the four immeasurables, bodhicitta, the six perfections, and all of that. So you find, whoa, which is more fruitful, which is more transformative? Time on the cushion, when I've temporarily disengaged from the world around, or the total transmutation of experience as I'm engaging with the world around? That's a bonanza. So we can imagine very little subtraction in between sessions altogether, as you're really developing, like the seven-point mind training and so forth. So then, who can say? You know? So I think we want to leave that as an open question. But overall, certainly the time-tested way to be the most efficient, just get the job done in terms of achieving shamatha, that is clearly, number one, make really good preparation. It's not just saving up money. It's transforming your whole being, transforming your mind, so that when you go into solitude and you have almost no hedonic pleasures, internet, television, radio, work, entertainment of all kinds, movies, music, et cetera, and just talking, when you kind of just cut loose from all of that, cold turkey, as you enter your mental rehabilitation center of your retreat place, that in fact you don't just freak out or start seizing up intention or getting restless or depressed or angry or upset or going through wild emotional oscillations because you just can't handle it. Like a cocaine addict going through the throes of withdrawal, or a heroin addict. You know, so you really want to get over your addiction to hedonic pleasure and to rumination as much as you possibly can before you go into a really rarefied, simple environment, and then just practicing Dharma all day. So one wants to really evaluate very carefully, are you ready for that or not? Right? This is a nice kind of midway house, because, yeah, you have 22 hours on your own, but nevertheless, you'd have that sports center over there. You know, if you want really tasty food, the divine, check it out. Oops, I shouldn't have said that. And the food here really isn't bad at all. And you have one of these with wonderful companions, this fantastic staff, beautiful surroundings. So and this is not exactly hardcore austerity here. Right, but it is simple. No television, at least, you know. So a lot can be explored there. But the time-tested way, transform your whole life, your view, your values, everything, so that you're ready to happily make the plunge into solitude, preferably with few companions, and preferably with a really good teacher, experienced teacher, in a very conducive environment, in a sustained fashion, and one that doesn't, you know, cost so much you can't afford it. And then you can see whether shamatha is possible in the modern world for people the likes of us who are not born as tukus, prodigies, and so forth and so on. But this is why, really, there's nothing else I'm working harder on at this point than working with people like Rhonda and people in Scotland right now, in the UK, creating one there, working with people in India, trying to create one in Bangalore, working with people in Mongolia, they have the land, helping them create one there. Of course, I'd love to see one in Santa Barbara, where I live, where I could kind of settle down and give much more sustained and in-depth guidance, and be able to practice a lot myself. So that's why I'm doing that. Because if you don't create the environment, it's not going to happen. just like if you wanted to promote neuroscientific research, but you had no labs, just classrooms. Then all you have is a system of belief. Long time ago, before the Martians came, neuroscientists were making some really cool discoveries, they said, about using techniques we don't know how to use anymore. But I've heard about EEG and fMRI and some other very... Of course, we don't make those anymore because we don't know how, but long ago, they were really doing amazing things before the Martians came. Oh, yeah. Maybe one quickie. From thanks. Okay? During morning meditation, you mention something like this: directly observe your thoughts, emotions, images, etc., not coming from some external object, not coming from the brain, but from the space of the mind. That is correct. Are you really saying images and thoughts don't emerge from the brain? I definitely, absolutely, emphatically, and 100% am. Beata. Yes, I am, definitely. The notion that images actually emerge from the brain is 100% superstition without any evidence behind it whatsoever. It's just like a bunch of dogs barking, and they all bark together because one dog started barking first. Really, I mean, I'm ridiculing it here because it's crap science. And I love neuroscience, and I've been trained in physics, and I collaborate with them a lot. I have a lot of scientific papers that I've co-authored at this point, so I'm not disparaging science. But the notion that images actually emerge from neurons, nobody's ever seen that take place. There's no evidence for it whatsoever. All we know is there are correlations between neuronal activity and the emergence of images. But the notion of one emerging from the other, to say, logically speaking, that if two things are correlated, which is the truth, that if A and B are correlated, B must be emerging from A, is just ridiculous logic. Even the notion that B must be located where A is because they're correlated, that's ridiculous logic. It defies scientific truths all over the universe. So correlations occur all throughout the natural world, but it never implies, just by the fact that there's correlation, that the two things have to be located in the same place, that is, thoughts have to be inside the head, or that one has to emerge from the other because they're correlated. That is simply preposterous. It's said an awful lot, but I think people are not thinking deeply. They just repeat what they've heard, and that's called groupthink. In politics, that's called groupthink, and unfortunately, this should never happen in science, but it has. So I would very much appreciate if you explain one time, doesn't have to be today, slowly and detailed, how you differentiate brain from mind. Well, we did that a lot during the week that you weren't here, so I invite you to the podcasts, because I think I spoke rather emphatically about that. Right? Hola, so. So if I'm wrong, I'm flamboyantly, fundamentally, fantastically, and exuberantly wrong. And that's how I was taught to be wrong. When I was trained as a monk and trained for years in debate, you never, ever in debate say, my position is, I think maybe on the other, I could be wrong, but maybe I think possibly this is the case. Hedging your bets, you know, just in case, like, nobody hit me. You just say it, pow, and then they go pow back. They critique your position, and you go pow back. You actually only one gets to clap; the other one just gets to sit there and take it. But you defend yourself. It's like putting up your light shield. Wrong, wrong, wrong. The other one's going whack, 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 and you say what you think. And if you're wrong, through good, rigorous, sharp, emphatic, sometimes very loud debate, then the falseness of your position becomes very clear and often gives rise to a lot of laughter. And if you're true, the other guy's like trying to, beat through a granite wall with a feather. Just can't get to you. They keep on throwing these darts, but they melt on contact. And then you just sit there. Give it another shot. Give it your best shot. So that's it. If you're going to be wrong, be emphatically wrong. And so that the falseness of your position becomes clear and everybody learns something. But that means you back it up with evidence. You back it up with reasoning. You don't just say it because somebody else said it. And that's what's happening in the groupthink of modern neuroscience, especially the cognitive sciences. One person says it, they all say it. The mind is what the brain does. One person says it, and then we just hear a whole bunch of other people barking the same tune. It's really terrible science. It's a complete conflation of dogmatic assumptions with scientific truth. And I have no problem with people holding dogmatic assumptions, believing ridiculous things, happens a lot. But to present a dogmatic belief with no empirical evidence, no compelling reason as a scientific truth, that's an insult to science. And that raises my hackles, because I love science. And we should never conflate mere assumption, mere speculation, with empirically verified scientific fact. That's the problem. And it's done an awful lot. So, that's that. Answered all the questions. It's 10 o'clock. Oh, for those coming in this morning, please come just 5 minutes late, okay? Get me time to get back to my room. Enjoy your day. Let's practice. Continue practice.